Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Hello, blenders, and welcome to a bonus episode of Real Blend, a podcast that has a mouthful of chrome and a one-way ticket to the wastelands this week. We are reviewing Furiosa, and we have a very, very special guest on the show. I'm Sean O'Connell, the managing editor of Cinema Blend, a co-host of the Real Blend podcast, joined this week by my fellow co-host, Jake Hamilton, who has seen Furiosa as well, too, and got to sit down for our very conversation, our very special conversation with George Miller. Hi, Jakey. How are you doing?
Hi, buddy. I am in honor of Furiosa today. I am recording from a place of abundance.
Oh, look at you. The green today? The green land spot today,
the green place. So I went and found a fake fern here in my newsroom here in Chicago. And
nice of you.
Try to spruce up the shot a little bit.
Whereas I coated myself in fuel. You can't smell it, but I am soaked in gasoline, essentially. Hi, everybody. How are you guys doing? We are back at it with a bonus episode. We are continuing to bring you guys interview content that we know you guys are enjoying. And we've been keeping up with, even though our schedules have been pulling us in all different directions, we've been trying to get to as many of the interviews as we still can and still bring you guys reviews of some of the bigger things that are coming into. We're going into the summer season. We have a number of films that we are efforting, some really outside the box ones as well, too, that you guys are going to enjoy. Some fun filmmakers that are going to be stopping by the Real Blend podcast. And there's a couple that we missed. We tried to get Krasinski for If, just give you guys a peek behind the curtain.
You didn't get him?
Didn't get him, no.
If it happens, capital I, yeah, capital F.
He was the quote unquote 100%. No, I mean, we didn't get him for the show.
Sure.
We got him for some.
I was just trying to rub in the fact that I got him for TV as well.
No, you know what it is? I haven't even seen If yet.
Oh, really?
I haven't seen If, and I haven't seen, what was another big one that's out now that I wanted to?
Apes?
Haven't seen Apes. No.
Don't you work for a movie website?
Yeah, I do. No, but there's another big one that Michelle wanted to see.
I give you a hard time about it, but the one thing I always tell people, and you guys can relate to this, like, I often find if I don't, because we're always covering something, right? There's always this next thing we have to watch.
Sure.
If something's not on my list of must watch it to cover, to do interviews or to review or what have you, it's hard for me to get, like, I just started Shogun. Because I didn't, it took me forever to get around to it. But on the flip side, I'm four episodes into The Acolyte. So, we a huge part of what we watch is our job.
Well, here's a bizarre thing as well, too. Do you know what I've never watched is The Boys.
And
I was talking to Gabe about this morning. The junket for season 4 is fast approaching.
Thursday.
And I'm going to do it. So I'm binging all the episodes up to this point. So any free time I have,
right,
I'm just about to finish season 1. So,
okay. I found season 2 to be a little lackluster and was difficult. In fact, I think I stopped halfway through season 2 and heard 3 was so good that I went back, caught up. And then I think Gabe kind of walked me through it. And then season 3 is the best of the show. And I am with you. I'm about to start screeners of season 4 to get ready for the junket.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, in the meantime, we'll continue to push our reactions.
Our lives are so hard.
Well, it is, but that's exactly why I have it. So I'm really glad they pushed Craven back to December because I need that time to just prepare for the awesomeness that's going to be. I'm going to watch
Madame all the other previous Craven
Netflix
movies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's got to read the books.
Yeah.
Craven the Gatherer.
You got to read those Spider-Man books for the Craven movie.
Well, I do have a Spider-Man book around here somewhere. If anybody would like to read a Spider-Man book, I can recommend this one.
Sorry, I'm gearing up for a Bruce Willis book.
I gotta say, Sean, it was a really proud moment I felt. I'm packing up my apartment and moving. One of the many reasons why we've been, you know.
And you have a box dedicated to my books. Missing.
No, it was a really proud moment because I'm packing up my bookshelf and I have like kind of categorized by sort of subject matter. And I have like my filmmaker biographies and Rebel Without a Crew and stuff like that. And then I picked up your two books that I have. And I was like, how fucking cool is this?
I had a similar moment, Sean. You'll appreciate this. I had a bookshelf full of books, and I just had so many. And you know, anyone who moves and has a bunch of books knows that is the biggest pain in the ass to move because they're just boxes of just weights. Heaviness. Yes. So I decided to take a large portion of them and bring to a store that we have here called Half Price Books, where you can bring and sell. And so I had a sell box and a not sell box. So every book I took off the shelf, I'd look at it and toss it in one box or the other. And when I got to the books by Sean O'Connell, no books have entered the don't sell box faster than.
Oh, I was afraid where you were going with that.
If you're looking for a jacket cover quote, Jake Hamilton says, would not resell this book.
Yeah.
Thank God. I was going to tell everybody there's a half price version of each of my book available at this current store in Chicago. Listen, we've kept the people waiting long enough, for God's sakes. We have George Miller on the show. We teased this on our social medias. If you guys have been following us, you might have seen a photograph of all three of us, myself, Jake, and Kevin, in Los Angeles for the Furiosa Junket. We'll tell some stories on the other side of this as well, too, about getting together out in L.A., about meeting Chris Hemsworth, interviewing Anya Taylor-Joy, and, of course, our guest on this bonus episode of RoBlend. This is George Miller talking about Furiosa and his entire career inside and out of the wastelands.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Stop in and save big money on your next outdoor lumber project now at Menards. Menards has the largest selection of AC2 pressure-treated lumber and decking, and it's easy to load in our outdoor lumber yard. Plus, you can get free estimates fast with our deck design program in-store or on Menards.com. Check out our weekly flyer for more great deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Mr. Miller, I'm going to kick us off by first of all just saying thank you for this is a massive honor for you to be on our show. So just seriously, thank you for taking the time. It goes without saying, we all know that the original 79 film is a masterpiece and has been a classic for 45 years. But I came across some original reviews of the movie when it came out in 79. One of them said it had all the emotional uplift of Mein Kampf and said would be a special favorite of rapist, sadist, child murderers, and incipient Mansons. I'm just sort of curious what you remember when some of those initial reviews dropped and what you think time has done for that film and just this series in general.
Well, I remember that very well because the first ever interview I ever had to do was on live TV for the national broadcaster in Australia. And that review came from an Australian reviewer who didn't like the film at all. And that was the first question I was ever asked on live TV. And I just didn't know what to say. And then I thought, oh God, is this what we've done? I've since, uh, I, I've, And then I remember there was a review from someone in India who said the people who made this film should be taken out into the street and shot. And I remember that.
Wow.
And because you only so they're the first two, and I sort of really I realized, but. I even knew back then that everyone has a different opinion of the film, but I was very aware of the responsibility of stories, and if people really, really pushed, that some stories can be quite toxic. The story should become with one of those warning signs like hazardous material, because some stories can be really. You know, can basically bring out the worst in people. There's no question. That's been a time-honored question that confronted, you know, Hitchcock when he made Psycho. I think there was something happened, some sort of murder happened where two guys murdered someone after they'd just seen Psycho. And Hitchcock's response was, well, is it Psycho? They could have eaten chocolate when they came out of the cinema. Is it chocolate to blame? That was his response. But there is a responsibility to filmmaking. However, in time, what happened was that the film, that review was straight out of Australia. In time, it was shown in Japan. And it did well in Japan, and then it was shown in Scandinavia and did well in Scandinavia and right around the world. And in Japan, they said, oh, this he's a lone samurai. Max is a lone samurai. You must have. And in Scandinavia, they said the similar thing. And in France, they said it's Western on wheels. Then I realized that the topicality that where a review like that came about was something that was specific to Australia at the time. And what was happening is that somehow the film had tapped into a kind of universal archetype. That very quickly got me saying, okay, what's happened here? The film has been very, very successful around the world. What did we do right? Because whatever it was, wasn't conscious. And then I began to realize, wait a minute, that got me onto Joseph Campbell. And I'm still on that sort of understanding of why not only what it is to... It's no longer a question of how to tell stories. It's also a question of why we tell stories. And that's why I'm still working in allegory. And that's what's so attractive about these films. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I still marvel at the technical achievements of these films and how a director can control as much as they can control. And I'm genuinely curious how many times in a Mad Max film, an automobile or some type of craft didn't do what you anticipated, but it looked so cool that you just kept it and went with what you were going with. How much of that are you able to control?
Well, it's in the first Mad Max, there was one moment that where there's a bike, there's a bridge, and Max drives towards these bikes, and there's a and the bikes slide. I think there's two bikes, and the bikes slide along the ground. One of the stunt guys, a guy called Dale Bench, as he slid his bike, the stand of the bike hit the ground, and instead of the bike sliding and him following the bike flipped forward, and he was flipped forward of the bike. And then the bike behind him came and hit his helmet, and you see him hit. It's kind of it was one of the shots that people still talk about because they thought that he was badly injured. Sure. What happened was that he was doubling a guy with a much bigger head, and he wore his helmet, and we put foam inside inside the helmet so it would fit him. And when the helmet was hit by the wheel of the other bike, it knocked the helmet forward. It wasn't so much his head. And Dale Bench, all these years later, was my driver on the last film, and we still talk, and he's the guy. It's really interesting, by the way. He was part of a bikie group If you saw the first Mad Max, he did a donut and a wheel stand, and he's chased by a dog called Wonder Dog in the film.
Yeah.
There's a picture of that group that I've got here. I was just sent recently of that group of bike riders. They were called the Vigilantes, and Wonder Dog, because it lived with the whole group. And in that picture, there's a guy there called Craig Hemsworth. It's Chris's father at 19.
Get what? Out of here.
He looks exactly like Chris today. Craig, he rode with that group of bikers. They used to race bikes. He was one of those that looked after Wonder Dog. He wasn't in Mad Max, even though all his colleagues were, because he was going to university to study social work. But I have that picture. So anyway,
my God.
So that's one thing that didn't happen. Mm. Now it's really important that everything works precisely. Okay. So the stunts, it's much more scientific now. The stunts particularly work with Guy Norris and the teams he works with and the stunt coordinators. When you have a vehicle rolling or something like that, and you're doing it for real, it's one thing to be able to do it and keep everybody safe. That's one thing. But it's another thing to make sure that the stunt is so precise that you get it in your cameras. Sure. Yeah. You have another camera. Just imagine you do a stunt and the car and the a rolling truck or vehicle misses the camera or is slightly to one side or another. Yeah. The whole thing is a waste. Yeah. So the precision has to be there. So things are much more predictable.
I think one of the things that you do extremely well with your filmmaking is your utilization of sound and score. There are moments in the film where Tom's score becomes like the narrative, like, you know, beautiful music of the sequence, and then sometimes you'll take the music out and you'll let the sounds of the vehicles become the score. The vehicles become the music, in my opinion. I wanted to ask you about that difference in terms of like when you use Tom's score and when you don't use the score and let the vehicles almost be the music, and just the sound design, like things going left to right on frame, like in the opening of Fury Road when Tom dries off and then there's like a sound of silence for a moment and then boom, over. Can you talk about just your use of sound and kind of narratively creating that for the environment?
Well, that's really important. I mean, and what happens traditionally with films and music is that you lock the cut, give it to the sound editors and the Foley artists and the ADR artists, and they do the sound. And then when you get that, then the composer comes in with his own sort of agenda, and very rarely do those two things dovetail together. And you end up with always in the mix, in the traditional way, of it being a kind of a competition between the sound effects and everything else, all those elements and the sound design and the music. And that usually is a process of elimination, but nothing, and it's usually, even though there's cooperation, it usually is a competition, and also one is basically redundant on the other, or tautological. You just basically, the both are doing the same things. In this case, partly on Fury Road, but in this case, we had basically two people in the mix, a really brilliant team, a guy called Rob McKenzie, Australian. Fury Road won two Academy Awards for sound, but they were very good. But it was a little bit chaotic, the whole process. This film was much more carefully designed in this process. So you had Rob, who had been a musician himself, mixing effects, dialogue with his team, with Foley and sound design. And you had Tom, and they both met each other very early, very, very early. And Tom, who is a mixer himself, and Tom was listening to stuff that Rob was doing and all his team were doing, and Rob was listening to everything as we were progressing the cut. So that when we got to the mix, the two were much, much more in concert with each other. And so they, and Tom was there, only two of them mixing. And they really, really, it was like they both understood each other's work, because Tom has mixed a lot when he was Junkie XL. He's mixed with a lot of big pop stars and so on, and when he was doing, and then he got into doing scores. And that made a big, that was a big, a big difference. So it was much more elegant and much smoother. And it wasn't that thing where you say, ooh, what, you know, there wasn't that feeling of, oh, what's really important. I'm really glad that you picked that up, because that's something we worked very hard on. I was really happy with that mix.
The engines are instruments.
Because the sounds of the engine. There's one moment, one of my favorite moments in the film, where we have Dementis running away from Furiosa, and he's running into the haze, the dusty haze. And then suddenly you hear a sound coming from the left of screen, and it's the cranky black car in which is, and as it comes into frame, and I don't know, at first I think it's score, like it's some sort of low strings or something, but it's not. It's the engine of the car. Oh, cool. And that happened several times in the movie, where you don't know whether you're listening to score or sound design or effects. And that was very deliberate and very, very close collaboration between the two.
That's awesome.
Hell yes.
That's
awesome.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
I read, and again, this is one of those situations where if it's not the truth, I'd love to get your version of it, but that after the success of Mad Max originally, that you were offered to direct a film called First Blood.
Not First Blood.
Not First Blood.
No. No, not the Rambo.
Rambo.
Ted Kotcheff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No.
I'm sort of curious. So you were offered the character of Rambo.
No.
No, never.
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
All right, well, then that answers that question.
Yeah.
So then I guess what I'll follow up with is that obviously audiences with this film are going to get the opportunity to see the image formatted for the IMAX screen, which this is the sort of movie that should be. Are there any moments from the original three films that you would love to go back and see on an IMAX screen to sort of know what that moment would be like?
It's a weird, from the original three, to be honest, you'll hear this from most directors, I think, that once you've finished a film, having gone through the process, you basically have seen every frame, not hundreds of times, but I'd say almost thousands of times, and in every iteration, until it becomes part of yourself, and then finally you finish. There's no it's very hard to go back and watch it because there's nothing you can do to change it. If you've made a film properly, you've basically put all of yourself into it. As they say, you leave nothing on there's nothing left on the field. Or what do they say? You leave it all on the field. You leave it all on the field.
Leave it on the field.
You leave it on the field. Yeah. So I've not gone. I've only ever gone. Rewatched a film I've made once. There was a screening in Austin in a theater where of Mad Max 2, Road Warrior, and this was maybe 25 or 30 years after I made it. As a special screening, and I went there, and I think there was a Q&A beforehand. And then I stayed and watched it with the audience, and I was able to watch it as if it was no longer in my memory, you know, and I was watching it for the first time through that audience. It's the only film I've ever watched. Now, it's not just me. I hear that from most directors.
What a gift. What a gift to be able to experience it again.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. But there's nothing, to answer your question, there's nothing I'd love to see them in IMAX, but I won't. No, there's nothing.
If you ever want to do a rewatch, you're welcome to come back on the show. We'll sit down and watch them with you.
Yeah,
they're really great. You should watch them again.
What is interesting, though, when you finish a film just like now, is now you know as I said, it's out there, and it's really interesting to see what people make of it. Because, you know, when you mentioned the Mad Max and you got that, you know, we got hit with that first question that you got the quote from, it took 10 years before Mad Max, the first Mad Max, kind of settled into the zeitgeist one way or the other. People were making of it. Took 10 years for people to basically say what they felt about it. And there's still now people highly engaged in that film, and somehow it has some significance to them. Nowadays, that process is getting quicker and quicker. You know within about a year about, you know, what the film has, what meaning it has, if any, to people, to audiences, and so on. And that's accelerating that process. Or you know whether they're completely indifferent to the film very, very quickly. It's in the way people talk about the film and what they take from it, which I find the most interesting. Because it's definitely in the eye of the beholder. You know, I've noticed that, particularly with allegorical films. That's why, you know, when Babe and Happy Feet, I'm amazed how those sort of films have different meanings to people wherever they are, in the globe.
Sure.
I find that really interesting, and same with the Mad Max movies.
It still changes, though. I feel like, you know, they just re-released Phantom Menace, and you know, this past weekend, and people were talking about it like it was a masterpiece. And 25 years ago, they were giving it a hard time when it came.
So it still
happens.
That happens for sure.
Yeah.
I had a visceral reaction during the film at the point where I assume that they're paragliders. Where all of a sudden you take flight. And we started arguing over breakfast this morning about whether you use cranes or drones. Have you ever used drones? Have you ever played around with drones at all?
We have. Interestingly enough, we on Fury Road, which is only 10 years ago, we wanted to shoot with drones. I've got an aversion to helicopters. My partner, Byron Kennedy, was killed in a helicopter. I've known two great cameramen, Australian cameramen, killed in helicopters. But we weren't allowed to use drones in Fury Road for the big wide shots. We had to have helicopters. Now, simply safety protocols. People didn't really understand enough about drones. Now, it stands to reason if you have an accident in a helicopter, that could be much more catastrophic than an accident with a drone. But whatever the case, that we weren't allowed to do that in the Namibian desert. But on this film, we definitely use drones because the protocols with flight paths and everything like that are now much more established. And they're an incredible tool. They're an incredible tool and very precise.
Yeah, so we're gonna...
So we did use them in this. So is that...
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you very much.
I think one of my most powerful shots I've ever seen in cinema is, and I genuinely mean this, is when Charlize's character is screaming in the middle of the desert on her own. I don't know if you sped things up because the sand is moving in a certain way, but one thing I thought that this film really did extremely well was it made that moment way more impactful because Anya's performance gives so much insight into the pain of that character. So now that when I revisit that shot, it just hits 1,000 times harder. So as a filmmaker, I was just curious if you remember filming that moment with Charlize, what that moment was like on set. I mean, I know you're obviously in the desert. Are you speeding up any of that sand moving? It looks like a vertigo shot almost. It's wild. Like a dolly zoom, it almost looks like. I don't know how you did it.
You know, you're talking about before about limitations and restrictions and being able to be adapt to the moment. That for me is a classic moment. We were shooting in the sand dunes in Namibia. We're shooting the scene that preceded that. And it was an incredibly windy day and the wind was rising to the point where the actors... There's a scene where she first meets the Vavolini and she starts asking, you know, who are these women? I want to take them home. And then she realizes, they tell her that it no longer exists, the green place no longer exists. We were shooting that scene and it was, the wind was so bad that the character with blonde hair, and there was, and there were a couple of the characters with grey hair, the Vavolini. And the wind came up so much that their hair turned yellow orange because of the dust in their hair. In fact, we had to colour them. Colour Abby Lee's hair, who played the Dag, and Melissa Jaffa, who played the Keeper of the Seas, and we had to take out the colour, and I was cursing the wind, and then as we were rushing through to get that scene done, and then the wind got more and more, and suddenly I looked across and there was a sand dune and the sun was in the right position and the wind was blowing exactly as you saw in the movie, and I suddenly thought, Charlize, let's go and grab that shot. And she just did one take. And the wind was up there. We got the cameras in place, and the sand is blowing exactly as you saw it. Nothing sped up, and we got the camera in place, and the sand was blowing directly into position. She walked out halfway and started to take her arm, and I said, "Stop." I gave her some note, but before she took her arm off. And did the scene, and we went back, and I saw that the wind was blowing so hard that the footsteps were being erased, and then she went back and did completed the take exactly as it is. We had two cameras on it, two cameras, and the sun was in the right position, the wind was in the right position, and that's when you sort of say thank you, movie gods, for putting it. But had I not looked across and seen it. And if had I not stopped cursing the wind, we would not have got the shot. And she knew exactly what to do, and got it exactly like that.
Unbelievable!
Damn, that's amazing. Yeah. Limitations, necessity.
Yeah, that's exactly what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking
yeah.
of thank you, movie gods, we would like to thank you, movie god, for this opportunity and for coming on the show. And this was a massive honor for us. So seriously, thank you. We hope you enjoyed the conversations because this was incredible.
Great. Thanks for all the great questions too.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate you guys. Thank you. Real honor.
I like the story of how you became the three amigos.
Oh yeah.
We want to thank our good friends at Warner Brothers, of course, for giving us time with George Miller and taking the time to bring us all out to Los Angeles in order to speak to him in person. The man could not have been more delightful. Jake, he's one of those directors that comes with the reputation of the fact that he's just a sweetheart in person, that he's a big teddy bear. And Kevin's been sort of teasing this on his own social media channels. They had a connection over the old film, How Green Was My Valley. And from the minute that we walked into the room to even set up for prep and the interview, and they're doing a lot of technical stuff, George like pulled him aside and was like talking to him more about that deep connection. And he just was, I found him to be such an incredible person to interview.
I mean, there are so many different things you can talk to him about. I mean, what to me, one of the most fascinating things about George Miller is that long before he ever made Mad Max in 79, he was an ER doctor. Like he went to medical school. He operated on people and then decided that I got this crazy idea for this movie. He was telling me that whenever he made Mad Max in 79, that they couldn't even use walkie-talkies to communicate with each other over the long stretches and when they would do the long, you know, road shots, because they were afraid that it would get picked up by the cops because they didn't have permission to shoot on these, you know, stretches of roads. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It was my first, well, I'd just gotten in before we spoke to him for Real Blend. I had just spoken to him about 20 minutes before for a lengthy TV interview. I got about 10 minutes with him. And you're right. Like, it's so funny. You think about sort of the types of movies he's created. His personality reads to me more Babe, Pig in the City than it does Mad Max. Like, he just seems like this fun, you know, kind of cool uncle that you know, you just want to hang out with and you know, I'll buy drinks all night if you'll tell stories kind of vibe. Yeah. So I learned a lot of things in that interview, not the least of which is don't trust Wikipedia when doing research for an interview.
Tell us why. What happened, Jake?
Here's what I'll tell you. Funny, you know, I really do feel, and look, I get the whole, like, you know, people would be like, well, you know, other people can edit Wikipedia articles, but I feel like Wikipedia does a pretty good job of staying on top of people's edits and making sure that no one's going in there and just messing with things. But I have found on more than one occasion that little small details in Wikipedia articles just aren't true. I've quoted quote unquote facts out of Wikipedia articles only to be told, yeah, that's not true. And the one that I brought up that was in his Wikipedia article, which if anyone knows how to edit a Wikipedia page, take this out, is that George Miller, following the success of Mad Max, was offered First Blood, which my mind immediately went to, okay, well, the timing kind of checks out. Like, that that works. And I could see why if he was offered one, he'd be offered the other.
Oh,
and
it makes a ton of sense. How, like, cool. You would see Stallone would be like, I would love to get the guy who made
Mad Max to do exactly that. Right. And you and I and Kevin, we got together for coffee and a little bit of interview prep that morning. And whenever I brought up this fact, I think you were like, dude, we got to talk to him about that. Because my question was going to be, you know, when you were pitched this character, at the time, no one knew who Rambo was, but when you were pitched the character of Rambo, did you at least start thinking about what your version of this character might be?
Sure. And we often let people know at those prep situations, we'll often be like, well, who knows if that's true or not? You know, like, oh, we don't really know if it's true. And then we're always like, hey, you know who we can ask?
Yeah,
we can
ask George
Miller if it's true.
Right.
Why don't we just ask him?
Here's the thing. I think I even prefaced, because I haven't gone back to re-listen to the interview. I think I even prefaced the question with, I don't know if this is true, but, you know, let me know if it's not. Not thinking he was actually going to shut it down. And then I got confused because I couldn't tell, was he telling me that he wasn't offered First Blood or like the next movie?
It definitely got a little bit confusing in the way that he answered.
Yes.
Because it made it sound like, no, I wasn't offered First Blood. I was offered Rambo. But then he was like, but no.
Right. So that's why no. I was confused. I was like, wait. So it's not my proudest moment. It's a moment that I will insist that we keep in the interview because I think it's important
for, you know, as often as our listeners are very kind about our interview skills and hype us up, which we greatly appreciate. It's also important to know that, like, sometimes you can do your homework and you can do your research and it just doesn't break the way you think it's going to. So let that be a lesson to you. If you've ever had a moment in an interview that you know, despite doing everything you could possibly do and it didn't go your way, it happens to all of us.
I'm not sure if I'm in the edit or not. But please pay attention to my face because nothing makes me happier than when you eat a question because you get such praise.
Zoom in. Just zoom in.
It's either Ridley's not answering what you asked him or George Miller is actively shooting down.
Yeah. No, Jake, I was not off. I mean, I guess I should just be happy that he answered the question.
Yeah, he actually did. Yes. Yeah, he was like, no, you're wrong.
Yeah, to be fair.
All right. So we're going to review Furiosa. And this initial bit for a long stretch is going to be a spoiler free review of Furiosa, because I think we can talk about it without giving away too much of the plot. And one of the things that I do want to point out as one of the hosts on this show who is kind of actively said I didn't care for Fury Road. It's really funny. I'm really torn with this one in this sense. My knock on Fury Road has always been I wanted more story. Like, I understand that this is like Fury Road was a pedal to the metal. You're not going to learn a whole heck of a lot of backstory about it. You're just holding on for the ride kind of thing. And my joke was they go, you know, in all really far in one direction and they turn around and come really far back. And the
you're not wrong.
No, I'm not wrong. And the action is what sells it. And it's fantastic. And so my knock was always like, oh, but I just wanted more story to dig into. Furiosa gives you more story. It's like answering that critique, you know, and yet I wasn't as interested in it. And so I don't know what I want out of these movies. Apparently action isn't.
Think Furiosa is more of a Mad Max movie than Fury Road is.
Okay.
You know, I feel like, you know, in over the course of 45 years and five films, you know, having just rewatched all of them, I mean, Fury Road's kind of the outlier outside of the original Mad Max, which doesn't really have nearly as much to do with the apocalypse as most people think. I think when most people think of what a Mad Max film is, I think they're thinking starting part two, Road Warrior.
Like Road Warrior, yeah.
Because the original Mad Max is, I mean, it's about like the gangs and stuff like that, but it doesn't lean into as heavy of, you know, the wars and the guzzling and these factions and as much as you know, as it gets to, you know, particularly in Beyond Thunderdome and Fury Road.
But then Thunderdome itself is a weird split, you know, of the two. Like, maybe there isn't a blueprint for these movies, you know?
Maybe it's just it's he's created the Wasteland and it's him just dipping into different factions of it to tell different types of stories.
Yeah. And we've kind of figured out over the years that you can't line up. They don't interlock the way the MCU movies do. You know, George Miller's basically said each of them is a fable in and of themselves, as if they're being told by different narrators.
Yeah.
And so the you can't sync up necessarily. Oh, well, this is the point during Fury Road. Although didn't Miller tell you?
Yeah. I asked Miller though. I said, you know, whenever you're making a Mad Max movie without Mad Max, do you have to decide during each moment where Max is? I said, if I were able to sit down with you and watch Furiosa and at any random moment press pause and say, hey, where's Max in this moment, could you tell me? And he said yes.
Yeah,
he said I know exactly where. But then he took it a step further and said he makes every decision. He said every character that he creates, he needs to know where they came from, what actions led to. And the example that he brought up was the guitar player from Fury Road. Mm-hmm. I mean, he said, you look at that guy and yeah, he looks really cool and that's a great moment, but like, what the hell happened to that guy to get him, you know, from being someone's son to having a piece of skin scraped across his face, you know, with a fire breathing guitar, you know, like, and he said, I said, so you can, like, any character in the Mad Max series you could give me, like, a biography on? And he said yes. So yes, I do agree. To some degree, obviously, yes, I think that it's a little bit of a fable. He also did say, and I'm genuinely not trying to, like, rehash my TV interview with him, but just thanks to you that are proving your point. Yeah. He said because I asked about bringing back Mel and if we'd ever see, like, an old man version of Max. And he said he has no idea who Max is in his 60s or in his 70s.
Interesting.
He said he has no, in the way that we've gotten old man Indiana Jones, he said in his mind, there is no such thing as like old man Max.
Yeah, I find that really interesting. And for various reasons, I think that's a difficult, you know, can of worms to open up.
Sure. But
and I've made this criticism that I think Fury Road, it would have been really different, but I would have liked if that would have been the moment to bring Mel in, you know, as Max, at Max at that level. But now that you've sort of reinvented it with Tom Hardy, you know, it almost shows that he's an ageless hero and you could drop him in all these different places.
I mean, at this point, is he more Bond like where it's the character matters more than the actor?
I think so. Yeah, 100%. I mean, you can't line up any of the Bond stuff. You know, it's not the same. Can't be the same person over and over again. And so with Furiosa, to get back to that just for a second, I think that this goes to show that there are far more stories to tell in that world, because you bring in Dementis, who's Chris Hemsworth's character, who is not someone we've met up to this point. You start to show the influence that he had over who's the dude from Fury Road with the mask?
Morton Joe.
Yeah, thank you. Their battle over, you know, valuable resources in the wasteland, and how young Furiosa was brought into it. I think you're going to hear this criticism from a lot of people. This isn't necessarily a spoiler. Anya Taylor-Joy isn't, or Anya Taylor-Joy is not in it as much as you might think.
Yeah.
It's a lot of, you see this young girl playing Furiosa in various parts of the trailer. That's because she's in a lot of the movie. I think she's great. I really liked her a lot. But you're waiting for Anya to show up for a long period of time. And even when she does kind of show up, she's playing another character to sort of hide herself. She's just in disguise, you know, and she's trying to hide herself.
One of the headlines to come out of the movie is I think she only has like 32 lines in the movie. So you're talking about 32 lines over the course of, it's a 2.5 hour movie. I think it's a little over an hour before she shows up.
Right. Yeah. So that's unusual.
It's 32 lines over a 90-minute runtime.
So you said you might want to see it a second time. Do you think you need another pass at it before you?
I do. I only because so many people who, and here's what I'll say, is I walked out feeling like it was fine.
Yeah.
Mad Max was, Fury Road was on my list of top 10 movies of the last decade when we do that back, you know, a couple of years back. I grew up on, my parents loved the Mad Max movie, so I had them all on VHS. So I watched Road Warrior a lot. And so I remember walking out thinking it was fine, but also feeling a little bit of a sense of disappointment. And I've talked to enough people who felt a similar way, attended a second screening, and then came back feeling more positive about it. Okay. So, you know, that has at least piqued my curiosity. And I'm going to be honest, I want to like it more. You know, I feel like we're almost a month into the summer and like, I haven't really loved anything yet. Like I liked Apes quite a bit, you know, but I haven't really like,
nothing.
I liked If. I did like If.
I feel like we're on a run of movies that are just fine.
Yeah.
Like, just totally feel fine. Like things are just fine.
I feel like that's going to be this summer, dude.
You know, Fall Guy was good.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Welcome to the remnants of the strike.
I guess so.
And here's what I'll tell you. One of my biggest complaints about this movie is that it just looks so green screen.
There's a lot.
Like there's, yeah. and I get before you fire back, I get that there was a lot of green screen in Mad Max, but it looked better. Mm. And it also felt like there was a lot more on location shooting for Mad Max. I mean, Mad Max to me was just so immersive.
You mean Fury Road?
Fury Road Fury was Road. So immersive. In the locations
not a lot
and where
of CGI
they were at.
In Mad Max.
yeah, exactly right.
Well, but also the selling point of Fury Road is look how practical everything is.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like the extent he went to capture as much. So when the CGI hits in this,
you
it's kind of jarring.
Yeah, to the point where you're like, that's not what I thought. Now, eventually, there are sequences that clearly are shot somewhere on location. But you know, if we're talking, you know, the percentage of the movie that's practical versus a green screen or a volume or a soundstage or what have you, the it's a wildly different percentage for Furiosa than it is Fury Road.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you this too, like we don't have to really hint of where it is. Like when it happens,
you'll see it.
It.
You'll see it. And here's the deal. Look, striking. I mean, going back to like look, you can fire back at me. I understand. Yes, there are green screen set sequences in Mad Max. They just look better.
Yeah.
They like they're, you know, I don't know what it is. We have figured out and accomplished so many things over 100 years of cinema in Hollywood, but one of them is not how to make green screen look good. It yeah. just, I feel like the average moviegoer, like I could show a movie to, I think, someone who doesn't know the industry and the behind the scenes stuff as well as we do and say, listen, point out a scene where you think a green screen is. And I think the average person could do it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's always surprising to me in something like, I keep going back to watching behind the scenes stuff of Zodiac mm-hmm. and seeing how much Fincher adds things in after the yeah. fact.
But that's, I feel like that feels different though. Like when you saw like the Kevin was high on sending us that, special effects reel that they made for the Academy for the Killer. To me, that's perfectly fine. And that's, sure. I think to me, that is an incredible example of special effects where like sure. you didn't even know that they were there or needed. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, that's Apple. Like what Fincher does for his films is completely different.
It's an enhancement. It's
yes.
not
yeah, the better scene. Word. That's a good word. Yes.
Yeah. The scene isn't dependent on it.
Yes.
And I feel in the Furiosa moments, it was very much dependent on.
Yeah. And on also like green. There were a lot of moments that I felt were green screen that part of me just thought, and look, I get that there are budgets and that there are practicalities and that George Miller is almost 80 years old. And I get, yeah. but there are some yeah. moments where I just thought, you couldn't have found a place to do this, like a scene on a rock, you yeah. know, a scene in a cave, a scene, you know, on a sand dune. Like you're telling me there was nowhere around where like you could have set up a camera and just hit record. And again, I get that I'm probably talking out of my ass because I've never made a movie. So, but it doesn't help that we've seen it done before in this series by this filmmaker. So we know he can do it because he has done it.
Right.
So I think that was, you know, that was for me the first, most immediate and biggest hurdle to get over is it just doesn't look as good.
Anything you want to discuss before we throw up a spoiler wall?
I enjoy Chris Hemsworth's performance. Okay. I thought this was a really nice example of what he is capable of when given a right director, the right character. Mm-hmm. You know, I... quite frankly, look forward to, and look, I enjoy him as Thor. I really do. But mm-hmm. like, I think he's bigger than Thor. I think he's better than Thor. Mm-hmm. And I think this, and he was in a film by Ron Howard that I really loved called Rush. Mm-hmm. I thought were two really fantastic examples of what he is capable of as an actor. And I think, you know, I think maybe he goes the route of a Colin Farrell, where like maybe he sort of says, hey, maybe I'm not going to do like the I'm a good looking movie star roles. Maybe I'm more sure. interested in the gritty, the low key, you know, the Martin McDonagh kind of indie movies. I think maybe Chris Hemsworth starts rethinking what he wants out of his career. Cause he was complaining in an interview that he doesn't feel like Tarantino or Spielberg like takes him seriously as an actor. And I think he, right. at this point, respectfully, you know, maybe quit making Thor movies, you know, like you had your time. Yeah. You know, it was a great run. You were part of one of the greatest runs in movie history.
Yeah.
And a great part of that run. But like this movie shows us what you can do. And I think what you can do is really interesting. And I think at this point now it's on you to choose, you know, the right role and the right filmmaker, you know, when and if they come along.
It's a really interesting point because I really wonder. Like I'll bring up Bad Times at the El Royale.
Oh, he was brilliant in that. Like well. Little roles like that. Also, if you've never seen Bad Times at the El Royale, that was on my top 10 list that year. That is such a, is that Drew Goddard?
Yeah.
That was such a great, great script. And you're right. He came in and stole the show in a role that I don't even want to say what the role is, but he's phenomenal.
So here's what I'm going to say might be frustrating about Hemsworth for Hemsworth's sake. I think he's fully capable of those roles. I think he's too handsome. Like, and I only say this having now seen him in person, like mm-hmm. at the junket.
Was that your first time meeting him in person?
No. I've interviewed him a couple times, but more specifically, him just holding court outside of the mm-hmm. room mm-hmm. where he was doing interviews.
Yeah.
He's 6'5". He's got a booming voice. He's the center of attention in every room he stands Thor. In.
Can I give one pushback on that though? And maybe this is I'm curious if you would equate them. That hasn't stopped Brad Pitt from doing great character work.
Fair. Okay, sure. Fair. You know? Yes. But in a way, what I'm saying is, because even using Colin Farrell as an example, Colin Farrell had to kind of had to age up a little bit and almost dirty himself a little bit. Like, he was very handsome doing his, you know, phone booth things and, you know, all that jazz where he was on a run. No, it's great. And he you could see in that moment, like, oh, he's capable of doing this other stuff, but he's got to get away from this a little bit.
You know, I'm sure on paper, Alexander seemed like a good idea.
Sure. Yeah. Or Tigerland and stuff. Like, I mean, he was pushing himself.
Yeah.
But I think Hemsworth has to get a little bit older, maybe a little bit dirtier. I'm not quite sure what it is, but it's like you see that package and it's like, there's only so much you can do with this.
Yeah,
like he's but you're right. Brad Pitt's a great
pushback. That's a really good example
to a great character actor. Okay. There was a spoiler element that you wanted to discuss though. And so I want to let everybody know at this point now that we'll come back with
just
star
one
ratings
moment.
At the end
just
of
one
it.
Moment, just one moment. Just because I want to get your thoughts on Gabe. Do you want to take your headphones off?
You're good. But I'll check timestamps and such. If you're on YouTube, I'll put up a little thing that says when we're talking about spoilers.
Okay. Sean, what were your thoughts on the moment with Max?
I thought it was unnecessary.
It felt just because at the end of the day, like he doesn't know what he's see. You know, it's you know.
Here's what's really specific about it too. It's framed in a way so that to me it mirrored the very first time that we see him in Fury Road, isn't it? Like, isn't he standing, if I remember correctly, standing outside of his car right next to it, overlooking the hill?
Yeah.
And if not for all of that, like, isn't that the only thing that really indicates to us that that is Max?
Well, and it's because of the back car. And, it's the interceptor.
So. It was, to me, a little gratuitous. It was kind of just like, well, we're going to include this in here because it's a Mad Max movie. But it didn't add anything to the story. It wasn't necessary at that point. So I didn't see a need for it you know, at all, really.
Well, the movie does two things that I think work against it, which is one, that.
Yeah.
Because I agree that I didn't think that scene was necessary because it doesn't add anything other than remind you of a character you love who's not there.
Right.
And then over the credits of the movie, they play clips from Fury Road.
Yeah.
Which I think is a mistake.
Yeah.
Because I just kept, while I was watching Furiosa, I just kept thinking, am I crazy? Am I remembering Fury Road wrong? Was like, is this what Fury Road looked like? And I have it built up in my head. And then when they immediately go from this very CG green screen heavy Furiosa to all of those beautiful practical shots from Fury Road in the credits, which I'm not sure why they did that to begin with. Mm. It just made me go, oh no, I wasn't wrong. That was just a better made movie.
Well, let me ask a question. Well, I think you're right in the fact that my initial reaction to seeing the Fury Road footage over Furiosa is this is a mistake. You shouldn't do this because you're automatically, because you're right. Even in the footage over the credits, I was like, that looks better.
Yeah.
That looks better than what we just watched. You shouldn't be showing this to us.
Yeah.
There's no way that, because by the end of Furiosa, you get the moment with her and the brides, right? So could the shot of Max on the hill, could that have been the first Fury Road shot? Is there a way that...
I don't think, because I feel like Fury Road happens very fast,
right?
Like he's on the hill, he gets, because I get the impression that
he gets chased, his car flips, apprehended by the war boys, they brand him, they shave his head,
and then instantly
it's
Furiosa's taken off in the war rig to go supposedly to Bullet Town,
so we don't have enough time for Andrew to
I feel like, because I also get, I felt like more had happened between Furiosa and Immortan Joe.
Probably.
In between Furiosa and Fury Road.
Okay. But what happens, I'm blanking because it's been like 2 weeks or so. What happens with Furiosa and the brides at the end of the movie? Isn't she shuffling them into the war rig to try to sneak them out? Like, I thought Furiosa ran us right into the start of Fury Road.
So are we? So you're saying that that shot of Max was the opening scene of Fury Road?
I think it might be. I'm only thinking this in the moment right now, but because it's staged so deliberately to look like the first shot of Max. I'm saying in the last 5 minutes of Furiosa, maybe Max took off, got abducted, you know, is being held captive, as then the end of Furiosa, she's shuttling the brides into the war rig, and here we're going to kick off onto Fury Road, which then maybe explains why the footage runs over the
well,
credits.
Well, then that, okay, then that actually does make me like that a little
that
bit
scene?
Better than, yeah.
Well, if you go back and rewatch it a second time, let me know
I'm going to go. I think I'm going to go this weekend. I want to go to, yeah, I think yeah, I miss that.
All right. Well, then I'm gonna reserve asking you your star rating because okay. I think it could change. I'm yeah. somewhere between a 3 and a 3.5 out of 5.
Yeah, that's where I was too.
But you don't think you can get yourself up to a 4, do you?
I would like to. It would make me okay. happy if I, you know.
All right.
But here's what I'll say. Like, you know, coming off of a movie that immediately I was like, this is going to be one of the best of the decade. To
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
I need to watch it again to get myself to a 4.
Shoes too big to fill? Like, just what, you know, maybe shouldn't have gone
back to the...
Not
necessarily, because like, Fury Road was so different than all other Mad Max movies. So, like, yeah. I didn't walk into Furiosa thinking it's going to be another Fury Road, because, like, Fury Road wasn't like another Mad Max.
Yeah. Yeah, all right, that's fair. All right, well, we have plenty more episodes coming up. Gabe, what can we confirm? Are we able to... let the people know about some fun things that are coming.
Yeah, yeah. So next week, if you listen to our sort of announcement about these run of sort of bonus episodes and things, I mentioned that you might see some older interviews hit the feed. The reason for that is not everything is on our current YouTube channel, and so we're just going to find some opportunities to drop stuff in. Next week, Kev is on vacation. This is why we're calling this a bonus episode. We didn't want to come back and then leave again, so this is technically a bonus episode, even though it's... I get it. It's a little confusing, but it's a bonus episode. Next week, we're gonna put up one of our older Tarantino interviews that's not on this channel. If you're a longtime listener,
which one is it? Do you know?
I think I'm gonna do Volume 2 because I have a lot of clips up from Volume 2. It's a longer one. The first one is only like 20 minutes, and maybe later down the road we'll add that. But Volume 2 is the big chunky one that I want.
I love that we call them volumes.
Thank you.
So great.
Yeah, so look out for that. That'll be next week. That is going to be, it's not just going to be reposted completely. We're going to have a new intro outro with Sean sort of setting it up and giving plenty of context about when it was recorded and things like that. But expect that next week. And then the week after that, I think is going to be our big return to the main show numbered format.
I will say we were up in Maryland for Michelle's mom's 80th birthday. And so I got to connect with a lot of people that I haven't seen in a really long time. And they, three different people brought up the Tarantino interviews as a way to sort of say, like, because I haven't seen people in years upon years, people up in D.C. who I haven't connected with in a while. And they were like, oh, this show is like, I listened to this show that you're doing. And they're like, you got to go to Tarantino's house. And it's like when you get reminded of it from people who, because we're in it, you know, week after week after week. And it's like, oh, yeah, it's kind of wild when you mention it that way. So I also told the guys a really fun story about PJ. Like running into someone who didn't know what his father did for a living. And when he told him he, you know, was a film critic, it turned out the guy had been a blender for a very long time since the early days and was very happy to meet PJ. So that, you know, a little bonus points for the kid over here.
That's why.
Being proven cool.
Well, the thing that we often, I think, sleep on whenever I think about what is probably one of, if not the craziest days of my life, was not just... being at Quentin's house, but the fact that Kevin Smith drove us to Quentin's house, the fact that there was a whole other day, a morning spent at Kevin Smith's house before he ever dropped us in front of Quentin's gates, and we all looked at each other and went, "What do we do now?"
And before he quit smoking weed, because we all brought change of clothes because we were worried that we would smell too much like marijuana.
And that was a whole thing. I remember that was a whole coordination.
We were like, oh, I remember that.
It's so funny. All right. Listen, we'll be back. So next week, look for the Tarantino. The week after that, it sounds like all of us are going to be back from our schedules. We'll be up and running and more Real Blend for the rest of the summer. We got a ton of If It Happens. We have a couple of things in the vault locked away already.
Who's coming later? Who's coming soon?
The interview. Wait, I'm going to steal Sean's joke.
Go ahead.
The interview is going to be a hit, man.
Oh.
All right. All right, we'll talk to you guys later. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.